Welcome to the second half of our program with William Engdahl, and we are going to change gear and discuss another very important topic now, the GMO question and the transformation of agriculture into agribusiness. In his book, Seeds of Destruction, from 2007, he outlines the dark agenda to take control over the food supply, who the players are, and what they've used, or how they've used, rather, the green movement to get the job done as well. I wanted to ask you, William, about the inception of this. I know that we'll need to go back to the Rockefeller Foundation, where so many things has their inception, of course, but also the Ford Foundation, Henry Wallace of the Hybrid Corn Company, later DuPont Pioneer. And this is, you know, before Monsanto, Syngenta, or any of these other players shows up on the scene. But one important point that you make, William, is that the science behind genetically modified organisms kind of comes out of the field of eugenics, a similar ideology, an alarming fact, of course. Can you tell us more about when the desire to control the food supply in the industrial times kind of start, as you see this being the inception of things?
Well, it goes back, as I discussed in the Seeds of Destruction book, which, by the way, will be out in Swedish sometime later this year. As I detail, the origins go back to the end of the Second World War. At that time, Nelson Rockefeller, together with a Rockefeller University scientist with the name of Norman Borlaug, went down to South America, where the Rockefeller family had vast economic business interests. And Nelson had the idea to do with agriculture what they had done with oil, i.e. create a cartel or a quasi-monopoly on the food chain. And he created a project, or the foundation funded a project at Harvard Business School in the early 1950s that created literally what today is known as agribusiness. That is the cartelization or the monopolization, monopoly creation of a handful of corporations that would control essential parts of the food chain in a top-down manner. And the former Eisenhower Assistant Secretary of Agriculture, John Davis, together with an associate of his at Harvard Business School, Ray Goldberg, created this model of agribusiness. And to do that, they had to violate standing U.S. law, which was put into play in the 1920s against this, precisely this cartelization through the Chicago meatpacking scandals. And they began with orange juice, something seemingly small scale, but they began with the Florida orange groves. And slowly they began to spread that through the creation of mass cattle concentrations, CAFOs, concentrated feeding organizations, CAFOs for chicken breeding, such as Tyson Foods in Arkansas, pig breeding, such as Smithfield Foods in the Carolinas and elsewhere. And by the 1980s, they had pretty much locked up the entirety of U.S. agriculture, such that the traditional family farmer, through the way that the USDA farm bills were designed by Congress and as a result of the lobbying interests of agribusiness by then, the farm bills benefited agribusiness to the detriment of the family farmer, so that many, many family farmers had to simply hire out as a contract employee of these large agribusiness corporations. So what we lost in the process was the quality of the food chain.
Yeah.
But also what we lost was the control over what goes into the beef or the chickens or the other products. And that was before the introduction of patenting of seeds by Monsanto and the various experiments of the Rockefeller Foundation on genetic manipulation of crops.
Yeah, precisely. The family farming kind of goes out the door. You have monocultures coming up, and then you have, of course, as you detailed, the kind of the petrochemical version of farming, the green revolution. You said this was basically merely a chemical revolution, and there's another factor then when you have, you know, all these big farmers using all these petrochemical products that the Rockefellers ultimately control. So it's about ultimately controlling the whole kind of supply chain, if you will, of human life, correct?
Yeah, well, that's what's so alarmingly dangerous about it. And The introduction, go back a little bit. All of the corporations who today or which today are patenting seeds, Monsanto, Pioneer, you mentioned DuPont and Dow Chemical, Syngenta in the Anglo-Swiss company, and BASF, which is a joint venture partner of Monsanto. All of these corporations have decades-long links to the Rockefeller orbit of corporations, and all of them are essentially chemical corporations who went into controlling and patenting seeds as an offshoot of their work in creating herbicides and pesticide chemicals. And the Green Revolution, Norman Borlaug's Green Revolution in Mexico and later in India, was a Rockefeller Foundation project initially, later joined by the Ford Foundation. At the time, the Ford Foundation was working intimately with the CIA and U.S. government. And the idea was not a dramatic increase in the food supply. There were horrendous stories spread about hunger in India and pictures of corpse-like children in the front pages of American newspapers to promote this image. But in reality, what was done was the way was opened in Mexico and in India and elsewhere for these large latifundista concentrations, these huge plantations that require little labor or certainly little qualified labor. And it didn't open the door for mechanization. Tractors need fuel. They need diesel. And that's a petroleum product. They opened the door for huge amounts of fertilizers and chemical fertilizers, nitrates and nitrogen fertilizers and so forth, as well as pesticides and herbicides. So that really was the origin of Monsanto, DuPont, and Dow's Green Revolution in the 1960s and 70s. By the way, the crop yields in the Green Revolution after initial spikes at the beginning, after 2, 3, 4 harvest years, much like with GMO, the crop yields did not improve. In fact, they got worse. So what it did was create millions and hundreds of millions of unemployed peasants that earned their livelihood and supported their families off the land, forced them jobless into the cities, often by police force or by brutality from the latifundista, the big landowners who took over. And the end result was the creation of urban slums, which on another scale opened the door for globalization because you have an unlimited cheap labor pool for Nike shoes or different things like that in India and elsewhere.
Yeah, well, exactly. You drive them into cities that connects with another, United Nations plan, the Agenda 21, basically, where you get people off the land. And these farmers, as well, that's a good point you made there, they are not men and women in touch with nature and the cycles. They're more, mechanics. They're engineers kind of thing.
Yes, yes. And that's the alarming thing. When we lose the, it's very modish to consider a family farmer as a country bumpkin in American culture, and certainly in European culture in the last decades. And young farmers don't want to be farmers. They want to get off the land, go in the city, have a job as a banker or something useless like that. But because that's where the glamour is in the media or in the television images. But if we lose the quality of a family farmer and the dedication they have to nature, to animal life, to life itself, the human race is in deep, deep, deep trouble. So we better consider this much more carefully. The mechanization, the introduction of technology. I'm not a Luddite, anti-technology,
sure,
by any means, but prioritizing the corporate bottom line, the quarterly shareholder dividend results of these agribusiness corporations as the only priority, and the needs of that family farmer who has to have enough manpower on the farm to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning if a newborn calf is in danger, and tend to that calf or do what's necessary and keep an eye on how things are going. If we lose that, we're losing the food quality, and that's exactly what we've done in the United States over the last 35 years. You can see the results in looking. You are what you eat, and look at the American population today. Not only obesity of an epidemic scale, but you have diabetes, and you have all these horrendous illnesses, which simply, including cancer, which did not exist in the dimension it does today, some 30, 40 years ago before the takeover of agribusiness of the food chain. So I think that is a scandal that is only barely beginning to be openly debated outside the specialized media that look at these questions of natural agriculture or organic foods and so in the U.S. and in Europe.
Yeah, you're unfortunately right. And of course, at the plus side, to mention something positive in that, is that there are a lot of people returning to older traditions as well. They want to go organic and they do it in a more wholesome way. But definitely the industrialization of the whole farming process have gotten out of scale. But I think it's also at the same time, it's beginning to take its toll at this stage. And of course, this in their eyes is going to be even more incentive for why they need to bring in, you know, genetically modified organisms that need to handle even, you know, better. We need to have vitamins in there, like the, you know, the golden rice kind of things that were going on for a while. But
the golden rice is still going on, by the way, but the Philippine peasants are burning the rice paddies and uprooting it. So they're having trouble getting that one over.
Well, exactly. I mean, one of the points there is that when you do not have diversity in the seeds, you can have just minor changes in temperature or other conditions, and you basically can have a whole loss in your entire crops instead of just having a few here and there. I mean, that's why this is so important. But maybe we can talk about the eugenics origins a little bit and how this has been kind of a shared ideology, I guess, with those who have been promoting the genetically modified organisms as well, William.
Well, this was one of the most controversial parts, and it's actually the essence of my book. There are numerous books out there which say GMO is a health danger for this and that reasons, and it's untested, all of which is true. But they ignore the essential point, in my view, of the whole GMO project, and that is, number one, the patenting of seeds and the control of the essential food chain, soybeans, corn, wheat, ultimately, which is now being brought out by stealth in Canada, Oregon, and elsewhere by Monsanto and others, and rice, as you mentioned, golden rice. And by patenting this, they are potentially connecting up with the essential food. Corn, of course, is a staple of the diet in many Latin American, South American, Mexico regions. The patenting of this, number one, but the second thing is the ability to turn off this technology through what is called genetic use restriction technologies, or GERTS, Terminator it's called in the popular press. The ability to have those seeds, those purchased seeds from Monsanto et al., commit suicide after one planting.
Yeah.
So farmers no longer can replant a portion of their seeds, as they have done for 2,000 to 5,000 years of farm history. They are literally in bondage to Monsanto. They sign a license agreement with Monsanto. They run risk of a lawsuit from Monsanto if they try to violate it. And the end result is a kind of new serfdom under GMO. And you can ask American farmers about this. They've woken up to the fact that they really signed their life away when they signed on with Monsanto under the illusion of a better harvest yield. But the other thing is, the GMO experiment came out of the laboratories financed by the Rockefeller Foundation. And the Rockefeller Foundation, since the 1920s, has been one of the prime, if not the prime, finance sponsors of the American eugenics movement. Now, for listeners who don't know, eugenics was what Hitler race doctors, Nazi doctors and race scientists did at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Berlin and in Munich, with experiments on forced sterilization, experiments on human twins and so forth, and to essentially weed out the undesirables in the human chain and clean the race. It was called race purity, Aryan race purity in Nazi Germany.
And this was done before that as well, William. This is, yes, the ideology was picked up by the Nazis, but yeah.
Let me, if I may, just finish this.
Sure, point. Sure, go ahead.
The point about it is the Nazi eugenics was financed right up until 1939 by the Rockefeller Institute, Rockefeller Foundation. So the American Eugenics Society, the British Eugenics Society, and so forth, Rockefellers, after the war, announced at a conference of the American Eugenics Society, as of today, the new name of eugenics is genetics. And they focused a huge amount of energy on controlling life, essentially, biologically, through a form of biological reductivism that is scientifically incompetent and utter rubbish, but nonetheless they do it because they dominate the biology curricula of most universities.
That's right, that's right. There is a very interesting case of, I think they're called Epicyte, the company that kind of developed something that's called contraceptive corn.
Contraceptive corn, and this is a company in the San Diego area. It was bought up by a North Carolina biotech company and since has gone off the radar screen for, I think, understandable reasons, because the president of Epicyte had a press conference. He was so excited. He thought the biggest problem in the world is too many people, so we've developed a strain of corn. When the male man, human being, eats that corn, his seed becomes sterile, incapable of reproduction. And after that press conference, that company simply disappeared from view. But the technology is there, and the U.S. government co-financed the field tests of that Epicyte sterilization corn. So you can imagine if that corn is infiltrating the seed banks of Oaxaca and other places in Mexico, which are the heart of the world corn heritage, and that has been documented by Ignacio Chapela at Berkeley University and others, that is potentially introducing a hidden form of population reduction that's absolutely as insidious as anything the Nazis ever did during the Third Reich.
Oh, indeed. It's unbelievable in the way that it's being... you know, what's dangerous is that this spreads in the biosphere. There are many other research as well that detail this in terms of how the GMO, you know, seeds and everything else kind of, it gets out there, you know, and it takes over all the natural seeds. And one of the big keys and the clues here, of course, that you go into in the book as well, has to do with this curious thing. And this has always intrigued me when the five Nordic prime ministers got together there at the cornerstone ceremony to announce the opening of the global seed vault in Svalbard, and that's on Norwegian soil back in 2007.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the significance of this and what this means to you, William.
Well, as I said in this article I wrote at the time, after researching all the background that I could dig up on it, this Svalbard, it's called by the BBC the Doomsday Seed Bank, literally leads one to think that certain elites are thinking in terms of a doomsday scenario, maybe with nuclear destruction of key parts of the planet and the seed supplies thereof. But the seed bank was built with the assistance from the Norwegian government, money from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, from the Syngenta Foundation of GMO fame, as well from the Rockefeller Foundation and others, of course. But the idea was to collect seeds, including GMO seeds, from all over the world, all the seeds of the world that they can get their hands on, and lock them into this seed bank in the interstices, in the bowels of this mountain on Stavanger near the Arctic Circle, so that it's impenetrable for an atomic bomb. I mean, literally, they had this criteria when they were building this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, but an isolated island where no Greenpeace demonstrators can conceivably reach it unless they get icebreakers and who knows what. What is the purpose of this? It really leads one to question, because seed banks we have in relevant places all over the world. It leads one to think, and it's highly, highly top security guarded, so there's no way in the world you're going to get into that seed bank as an interested observer or as a journalist unless you're writing for Monsanto Daily News or something. So the potential exists in my mind for Monsanto and these other companies to literally steal the heritage seeds of mankind, whatever they want to steal, from the seed bank. They've tried it in other seed banks, and patent that and claim that farmers who are growing basmati rice in India or Pakistan are in violation of Monsanto patent rights and have to pay a fine to Monsanto or something of this sort.
Yeah.
But it's it makes no sense otherwise. It just is simply beyond the pale.
Could it be that they are, I mean, could we connect this with an even more sinister agenda in terms of really trying to make an effort here to try to poison, then, if you will, the global seeds and the crops that are out there to kind of, you know, make the spread into the biosphere, all the genetically modified organisms, so that, in fact, when and if changes, the conditions rather changes, weather, temperature, moisture, what have you, there will be a fallout or failure of the seeds. It doesn't have, I mean, as you've detailed as well, it just has to be the Terminator seed technology in the seeds for this to fail, because we can't produce any more seeds. But what this would produce ultimately is a massive starvation on the planet, and this could even be portrayed maybe as being an accident, or this it yeah. accidentally happened. Do you see what I'm getting at here?
Sure. Well, that's speculation, of course, but what's alarming is that the sponsors of the seed bank have been virtually silent on why they consider this a priority, so much that they invest hundreds of millions of dollars in construction of this monstrosity.
Exactly. What's the significance of Bill Gates and Melinda Gates, their foundation, getting involved in this and funding? And as I saw it as well, Warren Buffett is behind some of that money too, I think.
Well, Gates and Buffett made a joint venture on their foundation money to pool it under the Bill and Melinda Gates umbrella a few years ago. But the Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, David Rockefeller, Ted Turner of CNN fame and so forth, all of them billionaires, created something back about 5 years ago in New York at the Rockefeller University president's office called the Good Club. And the Good Club, apparently from word that has leaked out through some of the attendees, the Good Club is concerned with the number one problem in the world, namely that we have too many people on this planet. Well, I maintain that as a result of Rockefeller Foundation population council projects and all sorts of things from the U.S. government in the last 30, 40 years, and wars, Second World War and other wars, that we are in danger of an underpopulation crisis in the next 30 to 40 years, certainly in Europe itself, and even in Africa, the birth rate has dropped to only slightly above net reproduction of in other words, a net growth in population. So it's only dramatically reduced from what it was 40 years ago in Africa even. And that was always cited as the horror case number one. China has a crisis in population from the one-child policy that's not at all overpopulation, but the opposite. And India is probably not far behind. So But the idea of these elites is that people pollute. They've said as much. People pollute. People are a pest on the planet. Ted Turner made a speech or an interview with a so-called Christian magazine back in the 90s where he said a planet with 225 million people would be pretty much ideal ecologically for my taste. So he could have his game preserves across Africa and nature areas and whatnot, I guess.
Right.
But, you know, the human beings, we human beings have our share of problems, and we really need to deal with them in a different way than we have by creating all these wars and horrendous inventions that kill and so forth. But the solution is not genocide against 9/10 of the world's population. And certainly, who is Ted Turner to decide who lives and dies in this world?
Well, exactly.
Yeah. Now, back to Bill and Melinda Gates. The Gates Foundation, the Microsoft Foundation, has become a major shareholder in the stock of Monsanto. The Gates Foundation, in addition to the Arctic Doomsday Seed Vault that we mentioned, is also a major sponsor of the Green Revolution in Africa, which is nothing more, according to activists who've gone in there and seen what they're doing in Africa, nothing more than a backdoor attempt to ram Monsanto and other GMO seeds down the throats of African countries, who are very skeptical because they see that in Europe and other parts of the world, the people simply don't want GMO.
In India, though, there's been some interesting developments where, you know, they've rejected GMO. They've been going after, you know, likes of Monsanto and others. That's a kind of a positive sign in this case. Have you heard about that?
Yes, there's very positive developments going on in India. The agriculture minister himself is known by Indians as being notoriously corrupt, and he's pro-GMO. One ought not to be too surprised, given how Monsanto and these GMO companies lobby governments around the world over and under the table. But the popular outcry in India against GMO, the fact that there have been harvest failures of GMO cotton in key parts of India repeatedly, and farmers have been driven into bankruptcy and massive suicides because of the humiliation of being indebted to the seed suppliers, who in turn connect with Monsanto for GM seeds. There's a major, major upsurge against GMO in India. The same in China, by the way. I just had contact with a Chinese agriculture professor, a friend of mine, and she said that the government is trying to introduce GMO rice in China, but that the popular outcry against that is extremely strong among the Chinese population. Some of the arguments in my book, Seeds of Destruction, or Hot It Mot Leave It, is the title of the new Swedish version that's about to come out.
Right.
The book was actually cited by Chinese journalists in state-owned newspapers as arguments against GMO in China. So if that's possible in communist China, it'd certainly be nice to see a little more freedom of the press in the free democratic media of Western Europe and United States.
Yeah, it's a good point for sure. Now, there has been some other interesting players involved here. We briefly talked about, brought up Maurice Strong as well. There was a meeting back in, I think it was Stockholm, right? There was another UN meeting in 72, where also a lot of these other organizations were pulled together. I think one of them was CGIAR, I believe, correct?
Don't ask me what the initials stand for anymore, because it's one of the Rockefeller agriculture umbrella organizations that now incorporates the World Bank and Monsanto and Cargill, Archer Daniels Midland, all the agribusiness. But the Earth Day, Maurice Strong has been a personal friend of David Rockefeller for about 50 years, as the record has it. He's a Canadian billionaire who became a billionaire, according to sources, by being friends with the right people. And I guess David Rockefeller was one of them that helped boost his career. But he made a major move into the United Nations and used the United Nations to create things like Earth Day back in the early 70s, the Stockholm event you mentioned, to start propagating the dogma of limits to growth, finite resources. We have to reduce our living standards and so forth. That was first launched back in 1973-74 during the first oil crisis. There were claims that the oil crisis of 73 was proof that the world was running out of fossil fuels, and that therefore we had to go with wind and solar and all sorts of things that simply use less energy, go to a lower state of economy.
Can you expand a little bit on GMOs as potentially being, or if they should be viewed or seen as weapons or bio-warfare? If this is, again, if we go back to the idea of a kind of a slow kill-off of the population, and that certainly seems to be going on in terms of how people are getting more and more sick, as you described earlier, that it's not an active, like, we're going to, you know, put bullets in people, but it's going to be a long-term plan, basically.
Yeah. Well, I think the... with GMO, and I would call it chemical warfare, and the reason is that the herbicides, the chemicals that are matched to the GMO, all of the commercial GMO seeds in the world today have been genetically modified for one trait, that is to be resistant to Monsanto Roundup herbicide or other like herbicides. The patent has now run out on Roundup, but glyphosate with other chemicals added. And these herbicides are sprayed in massive doses on the GMO plants. They kill everything except the GMO plants. But they're embedded in the plants, they're embedded in the soil, so they get into the drinking water. And scientists in France, biologists in France, have done long-term tests of the effect of these glyphosate chemicals that are used with the GMO crops, and they found that they kill cells in a human embryo, among other things. They produce tumors in rats, among other things, cancer tumors, and horrendous effects, but no government until now, well, the French government has just, under great pressure, agreed to make a long-term two-year study on the safety of GMO corn, Monsanto GMO corn in France. But until that study was made public late last year, no government in the world has financed long-term safety studies independently to see what the effects are, not only of the GMO seeds, but of the chemicals that are matched to the seeds. And to take that totality, the first experiment was done by Gilles-Éric Seralini at Caen University in France last year, and that caused such an uproar that the Brussels Commission made a fake review of it and said, well, we don't find that the study was done under the right scientific conditions, therefore we see no need to change our policy of admitting GMO Monsanto corn, MON 603, in the European Union. So,
Wow, yeah, I mean, again, I just go back to that question of how this has become accepted and approved. I mean, as you pointed out, the Rockefeller has been behind the science and the education of the scientists who they are promoting it. Every educational board of some significance, you know, when it comes to the education field, has tentacles of the Rockefellers, you know, in them pretty much. But the idea here as well, William, is that there's also within this scientific field, there's also same studies that are pointing to how dangerous it is. You can use the same science against them. What's curious here to me is that they've just taken the one version of this and managed to promote it, I guess, in the mainstream media, because if you go to the scientific journals, you see how dangerous it is. But yet this is the, you know, the drum that's being beat. It's just incredible to me.
Well, and Monsanto and co, the gene lobby, the four horsemen of the apocalypse, as I call them in the book,
yeah,
they are very, very creative at creating fake websites that appear to be scientifically neutral, front organizations that have innocent-sounding names like the Organization for Biotechnology and Safety or whatever. And they give out money to buy off the key scientists that do the verification for the European Union, the European Food Safety Authority. The EFSA scientists, including the head of the EFSA, have direct ties to Monsanto-funded front organizations and their research as well. So this is, you know, there's a huge conflict of interest, but nothing happens. They still stay there.
It's true, it's true. So how can we fight this, do you think? If you're right, William, if you're right in your assessments and the research that you've done in piecing this together, the situation we're facing is, of course, terrifying. It's the future of humanity that is at stake here, our food supply and everything else, and we have a massive opponent that is very, very powerful. What can we do, do you think?
Well, I think information is the first essential, and let me give one example that I'm very fond of how one single person can literally create a shockwave in the ocean that can create a tsunami effect. A woman I believe she is from Utah, was so upset by reading what Monsanto had spent to block a labeling initiative, simply to label food, saying, in California last year,
that's right,
label food saying this food contains GMO products. Monsanto did everything to block that and spent millions of dollars. She was so upset by this, she decided on her own initiative in Utah to create a Facebook page called March Against Monsanto. And that page went viral. She called for a worldwide protest, grassroots, spontaneous protest. No, she didn't bother going to Greenpeace or Friends of the Earth or da-di-da or whatever and get some bureaucracy of that organization to approve it. I'm not saying everything that Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth does on GMO is by any means wrong, but they have their own agendas. This was a grassroots action, and 52 countries had these demonstrations. Millions and millions of people turned out, and it was blocked out of the U.S. media, largely from reports I've gotten, but it wasn't blocked out in India, in Russia, in Germany, in Europe, and so forth. And that created a sea change of attitude against Monsanto worldwide. They reacted to that. So things are possible. Just an idea of the human spirit is the most creative weapon that we have to neutralize this destruction.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, you were talking about Prop 37, I believe, in California. There, they wanted to mark GMO. I think it was 37. Anyway, what I find interesting as well is that we're also still in this situation where we're waiting for external authority to kind of tell us what to do or what not to do. We go to the, in America in a way, people go to the, you know, FDA to get it approved or you know, USDA, you know, organic marked and everything else. People can still do things on their own and have, you know, independent people monitoring and watching things. I think there's such another initiative in the States as well, where basically, you know, companies that have, you know, produced organic products and everything else can get the stamp of an independent organization on it and thereby verifying it instead of going and getting these expensive licenses, if you will, from the USDA and everything else. There's a lot of things that can be done here.
Yeah, exactly. And Germany is a good example. I don't know how it is in Sweden or Scandinavia, but in Germany you have organizations, Demeter, Bioland, and so forth, and they are known to have the highest standards of chemical-free, non-GMO products. So people know that the Brussels BO label is pretty much a worthless mark, but the Demeter and the Bioland are highly, highly, and those are private indicators.
Definitely. Now, as a matter of fact, in Sweden, it's getting worse. You know, Syngenta has laboratories or, you know, production, whatever you want to call them, right next to some of the biggest milk and cheese manufacturers and stuff like that. They're right in there, you know, but because there's so few producers, unfortunately. But in Germany, they seem to have been doing very well, actually, in terms of keeping this at bay. And some of the, you know, the companies that were booted out, they had to go to the States, I believe, to kind of continue their research. So that's good. What is the secret in Germany, then, do you think?
Well, I don't think there's any secret. It's just that the Germany has a strong tradition of organic agriculture and natural food, groceries and things like that, and has had for decades. And as there became more awareness, there are organizations in Bavaria and elsewhere that sprang up to oppose GMO back 10, 15 years ago called Civil Courage. And they incorporated farmers and consumers, and that was very important. So it wasn't just the farm union protesting against GMO. By the way, the farmers union in Germany has sold their soul to the devil on GMO. They're completely on board with Monsanto. But that doesn't do any good because the grassroots farmers are, you know, they aren't going to let this in. So it's, and German media, television, I've been participant in several, a couple of television programs in Germany documenting what the dirty history of Monsanto and the whole GMO project is. So that there is still a certain amount of freedom in Germany, even though Monsanto made huge pressure on the German television network after the broadcast, but the broadcast cut out.
There we go. And then people, of course, know about Monsanto at this stage, and that people have to watch out for all the other companies by the names that we don't know of yet that is being set up to, of course, handle the public relations of the next wave of the GMO promotion and everything else. So that's kind of a heads up on that, the fact that the battle will continue, it seems like, William.
Yeah.
All right. Well, much more could be said on this topic, of course. We'll relay people further to Seeds of Destruction, your work on this, for more information. And as you mentioned as well, there's a Swedish version of this coming out later this year, correct? Will it be available through your website, or what do you?
Well, it'll certainly be available in Sweden. Anarchos Press in Göteborg is bringing it out.
That's right. Peter. Yeah, I know Peter. Yeah.
Peter Vincent, right. Yeah. So you can perhaps check with him when the publication date is due, but it's fairly soon.
Very good. And then currently as well, you're working on, you know, what we talked about last time, of course, more on Syria and this whole situation. When is that out to do you think, William, by the way?
Early next year, it'll go into print.
Very good. And give us the website then. That's the last thing here so people know where to go to find out more about your work.
Okay. Quite simple. WilliamEngdahl.com. One word, William, and then E-N-G-D-A-H-L. Good Swedish name originally.
Yeah.
WilliamEngdahl.com is the website. And there you can link into archives, YouTube video interviews, and current articles and so forth.
All right. Very good. We'll wrap up for this time. WilliamEngdahl.com. We'll have that linked up. And, of course, also check out OpenMindConference.com, the website for the upcoming event in Skanderborg in Denmark, and William Engdahl will be there together with a lot of other speakers, so check out openmindconference.com. Alright, thank you so much, William, for your time. I hope we can do it again sometime. Really appreciate it. Have a good day.
Thank you, Henry. Enjoyed it.
Thank you.